I'm Larry McClellan, and this is the conversation on racial integration. Just to give you a little bit of background, I just completed 16 years on the faculty at Governor State University, which is a university south of Chicago, and I was teaching sociology and community studies. During that time, I've also been an ordained minister, and I just left the university in January to become pastor of the United Church of Christ Church in Homewood, which is also south of Chicago. Do you know if am I going to be live recorded? Do you know?
Yeah, we're recording.
Huh?
Yeah.
We're live? We're on?
If you want to be.
Yeah. Okay.
It's probably the
starter
if you said your name and it's kind of the end.
Oh, you mean somebody's listening to me? Oh, fantastic. Hello. Hello. All right, I'll start again. This is... Are you ready? This is Larry McClellan, and this is the presentation on racial integration. And my background, both as an academic for about 18 years, has been in dealing with the whole phenomenon of racial integration in American suburbs. I've also been involved in church work, and as an interesting footnote in all of this, for 4 years I was mayor of a place called University Park, which is a suburb south of Chicago, and was directly involved in public policy making having to do with the support of racial integration. And I have the dubious honor of being one of those people who was investigated by the federal government because of my commitment to integration. We struck so deeply at the interests of the real estate industry that the National Board of Realtors pressured the Secretary of HUD to investigate my administration. And sometime after we're done with this stuff, that's a wonderful story that I'd be happy to tell you. But it was fairly wild. And so I have been deeply involved in the questions of racial justice, and I continue to be very fascinated by it. What I'd like to do today is to outline for you essentially the tools that are in place for dealing with racial integration in American communities, and then talk about the 5 or 6 major dilemmas that we've got. How come we continue to be an incredibly segregated society? How come we are in the same, we are in the sad box that James Farmer commented last month? He said, you know, the great tragedy is that there are so few white people that know black people, and there are so few black people that really know white people. And that we have this kind of incredibly separated society. You know, why has that happened? What are some of the pieces of that that have made that happen? As I think you are probably all aware, we have in place all of the laws that we need for this to work, for us to be a truly racially diverse and integrated society. And those laws really all fell into place in the 1960s. And there are really 3 important sets of things that you should be aware of. In 1962, John Kennedy issued an executive order that all properties that had federal funding involved with them could not racially discriminate. Prior to that time, it was very, very common practice for real estate people and for various kinds of real estate owners and financial institutions to be engaged in racially discriminatory practices. Very simply, what that meant was that you showed whites these kinds of housing, and you showed blacks these kinds of housing. And you didn't deny housing, you just showed people separate housing. And that's been part of our very strong tradition in the real estate industry for the last 50 years. Now, that's all part of the lecture I gave yesterday. But Kennedy, in 1962, issued an order that said, if you have federal funds, you can't do that anymore. And so, but they didn't have any teeth to it. And so in 1964, in the civil rights law, there was a chunk added in there that puts some, the Congress puts some teeth behind that law. So if you had federal funding in your housing somehow, you had to, you would receive penalty. That still had very, very limited effect. And the key law for all of our concerns was the law passed in 1968, part of the Civil Rights Law of 1968, known as Title VIII, which was titled the Fair Housing Law. And the Fair Housing Law, through a variety of ways, identified forms of discriminatory practice. And the key thing to understand in discriminatory practice is that practice of separating when people are looking for housing. And it's what is classically referred to as the dual housing market, that white home seekers are shown white areas to live in, black home seekers are shown black areas to live in, and racially integrated areas. Now, the obvious consequence of that is that the whites stay in white areas, the blacks stay in black areas, and any area that's integrated, as over the course of time, whites and blacks leave, they are replaced only by blacks, it's inevitable that integrated areas become all black. And so part of the whole effort at fair housing legislation was to try to break that dual housing pattern. Now, the problem is that even though this law is on the books, it has been very, very difficult to develop the enforcement mechanisms for dealing with that law. And we have today, in the latest major national study that was done, it was demonstrated that over 85% of black families looking for housing experience active discrimination in their search for housing. 85%. And that is why it continues to be, I believe, a serious national issue. Of course, it's now a national issue that has basically disappeared because much of the fair housing efforts that have gone on are beginning to be undone over the last several years. But that's, again, part of the story we'll get at. But, so kind of big major point number one is we have a series of laws on the books. There have been a series of court cases that have made it very clear you do not discriminate against people in terms of their search for housing. Second major big point is, even given all those laws and those court cases, we continue to have very, very active discriminatory practices going on. And let me assure you, if you live in a community that has a significant black population, you can bet, and I would put money on it, that there is active discriminatory activity going on. It simply refuses to die. I'm the pastor of a congregation in a very comfortable Chicago suburb. The suburb is about 12% minority. Mostly black, a few Asians. I had last month, a white family that joined the congregation said, could you tell me about something? They said, well, what was that? And they said, well, we had to tell our real estate person three times to show us a house in Homewood. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, the real estate agent kept telling us, well, you don't want to live there because, you know, it's changing. And, of course, that had happened 6 months earlier. And, you know, for us to go back and find the violation and all the violators and so on would be extremely difficult. But the power of the discriminatory practices in housing are very, very much alive in our society. And I plead with you to understand that. And if you live in a community that has any number of minority members, you know, you get me in there for a week and I'll find the discriminatory stuff. I mean, it is there. Don't be deluded, please. I beg of you, understand that. Now, given that that kind of activity is going on, how do we understand how all of us kind of see this or are involved with this? And I want to point to five or six kinds of pieces that I think help us to understand how come that's still going on? Why is it that we're still caught in a kind of a web of discriminatory practice, even though the books say, the law says, we're not supposed to do that anymore. Okay. Let me suggest a set of things. Some of these we all participate in. Some of them are forces that are almost beyond our control. First of all, I think that we are all affected as individuals, as church people, as real estate people, as whatever. We are all affected by a tension between understanding whether or not we're supposed to be a melting pot or whether we're supposed to be a stew pot. And the old American ideology is that we're a melting pot, that all of us, everyone that comes into our society, we're all going to end up being more or less alike. But the reality is that we are a pluralistic society, and I like very much the image of the stew pot rather than the melting pot, that we all get in the stew together, and some of us may be carrots and some of us may be celery, but that we retain something of that flavor, but we also end up sharing a lot. But it could be unfortunate if we started confusing the celery with the carrots. We've got to understand what we are, that we are a stew pot. We are a pluralistic society. And that, I think, is fundamentally important, because when we talk about race and integration, most of us, speaking as a white person, most of us kind of subtly assume that if there's certain kind of patterns that we used, then everybody else is going to be able to use those same kind of patterns. You know, I've never experienced discrimination, you may feel. Therefore, nobody else is going to experience it because our community is da-da-da-da-da. Well, in point of fact, our communities are made up of very, very different kinds of folks. And your experience in search for housing is not going to be like somebody else's. And it is certainly not, if you are white, it's not going to be like a black person's. If you are black, it's going to be different from a Hispanic person's. That's kind of a fundamental understanding. The second reason it's important to see that we are a stew pot is because we need to understand that our diversities and our different experiences mean that we have a collective problem. Whenever we talk about integration, we tend to load the problem onto black families. Right? When we talk about integration, it becomes a black problem. It isn't a black problem. It is a community's problem because a community is diverse. And if anything, it may be a white problem that we have discrimination because we tend to not see it. Hispanic families, black families, Asian American families, they fully understand the meaning of discrimination in their housing search. White families don't. And so we have to be careful that when we're talking about the problem of discrimination, it's not a problem for a problem that is created by blacks, but rather it is a problem of the community. All the time, when I talk with folks about integration, the assumption is if the black families weren't here, we wouldn't have a problem. That's not the case. You know, we're the ones that are, it's the institution of the community that carry on the discrimination. Okay. All right, so when we try to figure out, well, what's going on? Number one, then, we really need to see that we're a stew pot, that we really are pluralist, even in a lot of communities that may appear to be very homogenous are probably at base a lot more pluralistic than we think. Okay, second dilemma, big dilemma, is the dilemma in the difference between what we call general acceptance of one another and specific acceptance. Very interesting set of research about racial integration that shows that we have, as a society, made remarkable progress in the last 30 years in terms of our general acceptance levels between blacks and whites in American society. And I think you all would affirm this, that, you know, it is no longer appropriate for a politician anywhere in the United States to get up and say, use derogatory phrases about black people. You know, American politicians do not do that anymore. Whereas in the 1950s and the early 60s, it was still common practice to use coon or whatever derogatory expression they wanted to use. That is because there has been a remarkable shift statistically in our general acceptance of equality for blacks and whites. And that's a positive. It's on the order of like a shift from something like 20 or 30% of whites were willing to see full equality for blacks in the 1950s to today. It's like 70, 80% of whites feel, you know, that's a dramatic shift. However, when you move from the area of general acceptance of race to specific acceptance of race, that is, as white families, would you be willing to have a black family on your block? There has been statistically very little change. So, kind of the second dilemma we have to look at is the fact that even though white Americans have evidently shifted in their attitudes towards people of color, in general terms, there has been relatively little shift in terms of their attitudes in specific terms. Would you want them, when the questions are cast in very specific terms, in your community, you know, living on your block, and so on? All right, that's a dilemma we also need to consider. It seems to me to think we can be relatively hopeful about that shift in attitudes because we have seen important shifts over the last century in terms of attitudes towards Irish, towards Catholic. You know, it used to be a very, very virulent anti-Catholic tradition in this country that really changed dramatically. And, you know, it was really the 60s, the late 50s, early 60s, and then the 70s. We really have gotten through the anti-Catholic thing for the most part. So I think that the general and specific acceptance issue, there's some hopefulness there. Okay, third tension or area that's a real problem when we talk about integration: the dilemma between community rights and individual rights. And this gets into very, very complicated stuff, but I'll try to outline it as clearly as I can. Essentially, communities have a right to ensure a diverse, stable environment for their citizens. Okay? We'd all agree to that. The real estate and financial industry maintain that they have the freedom to engage in their particular economic pursuits, that is, the sale of housing. And when you talk about racial integration, you pit the community right of people through their local government to control the activity of real estate people up against the real estate people's right to operate as independent entrepreneurs. And that becomes a very significant constitutional battle. Right now, I'm involved as a witness in a case that's working its way through the courts in Chicago that has the potential of going to the Supreme Court, because that really revolves around this fundamental issue. Do communities have a right to defend themselves as racially diverse communities over against the right of realtors who say, you are interfering with our business? And I think you can see the basic dilemma, because from the real estate point of view, the more flexibility they have in their operations, the more they have control over their own economy, their own making of money. And in fact, real estate people, money is made on transactions, the turning over of property. Whereas communities see their interests in the stability of a community. And ideally, a community doesn't want anybody to ever leave, because that adds to stability. And so, you know, that's where the community and the individual rights come right up against each other. And we've got a very strong tradition in this country that people have a right to pursue their economic objectives. And we have a very strong tradition in this country that communities have a right to defend themselves. And there's a very important crunch point there. It is complicated by the fact that the real estate industry has been deeply involved for the last 80 years in the development of discriminatory practices. But that was yesterday's lecture. But we have this individual rights versus community rights problem. Okay, you with me? Okay, all right. I'm kind of giving you like headlines so that I can kind of take you through the sets of arguments that are involved with this, as you can see, some of the complexity. Okay, four, I'm on four. Four is another very fascinating dilemma when we talk about racial integration. And that's the dilemma between the anti-discrimination position and the pro-integration position. Now, I'll take you through this. In the early 1960s and through the 60s, when all of us saw the kind of the wave of civil rights kinds of activism and other kind of things happening, there was an ongoing rhetoric of one society. You know, the Kerner Report said, you know, the danger is we're two societies, one white and one black. People talked about the building of a unified society, of overcoming our separation, segregation. The rhetoric of Dr. King was toward one society, toward an integrated society. How is it that blacks and whites come together? How do we overcome the legacy of slavery, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? Now, when it gets into the Congress, the legislation, including the Civil Rights Act of 68 that comes out, is not pro-integration legislation. It is only anti-discrimination. That is, you stop discriminating against black people in the following areas. Bam, 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 bam. It's a a pushing down of things, not a raising up of things. So the pro-integration rhetoric, let us become one society, becomes legislation that says stop discriminating. So what evolves over the last 20 years are two traditions. There's one tradition that says the law says don't discriminate anymore. There's another tradition that says we got to stop the discrimination, but we also have to take positive steps to increase the possibility for integrated living. All right, now, the real estate industry has been dragged kicking and screaming into obeying the law. They have adopted this position over here. And what they do is that they say, and you know, and I think a lot of people in the real estate industry that I know, and some of my best friends are realtors. People in the real estate industry have made a genuine effort to say, we are seeking to stop discrimination against minority people. But there are a lot of us who are saying that's not where you stop. We have to stop the discrimination, but we also have to take a variety of positive steps towards the creating of an integrated society. Let me give you an example. There is probably the heaviest issue revolves around the meaning of a phrase called affirmative marketing. And affirmative marketing,
the pen doesn't work.
In affirmative marketing, the real estate people have an affirmative marketing agreement that says, we will stop discriminating. We won't discriminate against blacks. The federal government developed an affirmative marketing agreement that says, not only do you stop discriminating against blacks, but you also take steps to market your housing toward those parts of the community that might not otherwise be interested in your housing. Not talking about any kind of quota system, but rather a marketing effort. The federal system said, you look at your metropolitan area and look at the market for your housing, and then seek to attract those parts of the market that might not otherwise be attractive. So if you are in basically a white area, and there are a lot of blacks and Hispanics in your metropolitan area, you need to do certain kinds of marketing, develop a marketing plan to attract some blacks and Hispanics. Or if you're in a heavily black area, you need to do some marketing tactics to attract whites. Now that doesn't mean you go out and set quota systems and drag people in, but you make a good faith effort through your marketing to market affirmatively. We have a predominantly black area, we are going to affirmatively market to attract whites if we can. Maybe they're not going to come, but we'll make the effort. you know, predominantly white area, we're going to affirmatively market to attract blacks, and whether they come or not is their business, but we're going to make that effort. Now, one of the fundamental issues going on is the realtor's insistence that all we have to do is stop discriminating, and in some areas, the Fed's saying, well, no, that's not all. You have to also take certain steps to overcome past patterns of discriminatory practice by affirmatively marketing. In a way, it's roughly analogous to affirmative action in employment. You know, again, where there was that, there were many places where quota systems in employment were not established, but rather good faith affirmative efforts were made to try to attract parts of the market, the job market, employees that weren't in your business or industry. Okay, we're involved in a very serious debate, and to date there have probably been about $3 or $4 million in legal fees spent on which one of these definitions makes most sense. I mean, we're talking about a heavy-duty argument. Between this business of, does integration mean simply stop discriminating, or does it mean stop discriminating and do what you can to create the conditions so that you overcome the separation that we've had? All right, that's a really big issue. Okay, number five, we have attention. Yeah.
Who would pay for the affirmative market? The realtors.
The way it has worked in practice, particularly the two areas where it's been most complexly followed up on, are in the Cleveland metropolitan area and the Chicago metropolitan area. There have been examples in other places, but those are the two major examples. Understandably, the real estate industry has said the affirmative marketing agreement that we sign is simply that. It's an agreement. We agree that we will not discriminate, period. The municipalities, the local governments say, that isn't enough. You not only have to stop discriminating, but you also have to demonstrate to us that you are making good faith efforts to develop a racially diverse clientele. And so the municipalities are involved in developing PR materials, putting money into that, and they are also pressuring the real estate people to develop a plan, which means some allocation of their resources. And again, that's where the anti-discrimination, pro-integration thing also gets into the individual rights, community rights. Because the communities are saying, we expect you to spend money in ways that you may not be willing to spend it. And you see, it's really insidious. Consider, for example, if you live in a racially integrated community and you like that. And you say, boy, isn't it terrific? You know, my wife and I have made a commitment in our life that we're going to stay in the region, in the south suburbs of Chicago, which are racially integrated, because it is really important for our children to grow up in a multiracial society. We believe we have a right to be in a place where real estate agents don't screw our communities. What then do you do? How then do you structure it things in such a way so that your local government protects your interests, because we believe that the law intends that we have one society. The real estate community believes that the law intends that they simply stop discriminating. You see, there's a kind of a profound philosophical difference. Then that's where the money issue gets real heavy duty, because our notion is that communities, real estate people, and others ought to spend money to make racially diverse communities happen. I will give you my interpretation. This is, understand, an interpretation. A real estate person would have a different interpretation. My interpretation is that historically, and I could run out a whole set of arguments, since the 1920s, historically, the real estate industry has kind of fought a rearguard action. Every time people have raised racial justice issues, they fought it, fallen back one step, fought it, fallen back, fought it, fallen back. Having given that interpretation,
the voluntary affirmative marketing agreement that was created in, I think, 78 or 79, to me is a, was a an agreement by the real estate industry to change the language of affirmative marketing and kind of protect themselves. They could say, yes, we're affirmatively marketing. But think about it. Affirmative marketing means you're making positive effort. But what the real estate community is doing is simply that we're going to stop doing this. Whereas the fair housing folk have always used affirmative marketing, mean you take affirmative steps to make good good faith efforts. So that grew out of a resolution of certain conflicts between HUD and the real estate industry in the late 70s.
Yeah. What would happen, is it illegal for a realtor, if you come in and you're from out of town and you don't know the areas, you're being transferred in, and you specify, I like a white upper class area, is it illegal for them to show you that area?
Yes. No, well, I mean, you got to be careful about it.
I mean, I know that they can't say you want a white upper class area.
Yeah.
I mean, they can't, I understand that, but if you specify, I want an all-white area,
okay,
I want to discriminate.
Right, there are two, all right, there are a couple reactions that a real estate person could make. One reaction would be, I would be delighted to show you all the upper-class areas that are here in our region. And, you know, what range of houses you're in, because of the law, I cannot... I am, you know, bound that I can, you know, that I cannot make discriminatory statements to you about which is white and which is black. That's one thing they could do in response to you. Another thing they could do is to say, if they have been through some fair housing training programs, is to say, gosh, I understand what I think you may be saying, but you know, here in our metropolis, all the communities are integrated. There is not such thing as a white upper class community. And so, you know, I'll happy to show you those things.
What if that isn't true?
Well, that's what I'm saying. In a lot of areas of the country, that could be true. And if they really have been through some training programs and have found out how to deal with that, they might say something like that. But, you know, they've got really those two kind of options. Oh, the third thing they could say is, I'd be happy to show you some, you know, various neighborhoods, but if you're concerned about the racial makeup, I'd recommend that you go talk to the local fair housing agency. Which is, there are a number of places in the country where they do that automatically when questions of race come up. But for example, one of the things you'd be, in most metropolitan areas in the country now, you would be very, very hard pressed to find communities that are exclusively white, and that, you know, that's a sign of some hope. But the common perception is that there continue to be exclusive white communities. Like in Chicago, people all the time are identifying, well, these are the white communities, and they are, yes, predominantly white, but in fact they have minority settlement now. Yeah. Okay, let me come to that as the next. That's I've got two other areas I want to point to. Let me just pick up on that. One of the most fascinating dilemmas now in talking about integration in American communities is the question of the relation of class and race. And there's a very big argument, first of all, that I'm sure all of you are aware of, is the basic problems that we have in American society, are they a function of class differences or are they a function of racial differences? And those things are very much bound up because historically, part of the white view of the black community has tied blacks to lower income, class perception. And so you still find the reaction of many whites is that when you talk about blacks or black settlement, their immediate reaction is lower income. One of the things that's fascinating in both Cleveland and Chicago, and well, there's also some examples of it in Los Angeles that I'm aware of, there are a number of suburban communities where the black settlement has reflected a significant increase up in the per capita income because the black families moving in are of higher levels of education, higher incomes than the white communities they're moving into, which is an interesting kind of wrinkle. There appear to be two kinds of things, well, let me identify three kinds of things happen. And again, this is an oversimplification. One is that there is a, in many areas of the country, in cities and in suburban areas, there is what we might call the pressure of the expansion of black ghettos, where modest income black communities are expanding. And because of various kinds of discriminatory practices, they're kind of expanding on the edges of existing black communities. Those often are places where you find lower income and very modest income black families. Secondly, there's a very interesting phenomenon of middle class and professional black families moving into suburban areas and certain areas of the city. And part of the dilemma, and I think this begins to point to your question, part of the dilemma with that is that the black families, middle-class professional black families moving into middle-class professional established white areas are moving in because they share all the same values. So they are coming in feeling we, as black families, are moving in a community that represents our values. Many of the whites living there perceive the blacks not as having shared values, but as being of the, you know, in the lower income thing. And so you immediately have a misperception. You know, black family moves into a very affluent white community. The black family feels they've kind of arrived where their kids are going to have good schools and they're going to all this kind of stuff. And the whites are looking and say that, you know, some lower income people have just moved in. So there's an initial, you know, kind of perceptual gap that that creates some real problems. There are lots of places around the country that are having to struggle with that, and I think that's an area where our churches, middle-class churches, United Church of Christ, Presbyterians, Lutherans, and others, there may be extremely interesting and important work for us to be doing in terms of, given that for good or for evil, we are basically middle-class churches, that there may be real ministry for us in terms of developing racially diverse congregations in those kind of communities. The third phenomena in class and race that has a real bearing on housing is the polarization developing within among blacks in terms of class distinctions. And it's I think it's important to say that I am generalizing, and I want to do this without distortion. It appears that there is more and more examples of a kind of a tension between middle-class black families and what is an appeal for the solidarity of middle-class black families with urban black communities. The rhetoric of urban black politicians is that black middle-class folks that leave the city are deserting the base. And I think the position taken by middle-class black families is they are moving to the suburbs because they want safe neighborhood, good schools, nice house, etc. And there's a very interesting polarization going on. It's the kind of thing that William Wilson, in the very controversial book called The Declining Significance of Race, ignited a whole controversy among sociologists, particularly black sociologists, about the class distinctions that are evolving within American blacks. And that's a very interesting part of this whole phenomenon. In the communities that I've been directly involved with, most of my work has been in suburban communities. And I have seen many, many instances where there is a very clear commitment by white families and black families to building a kind of a suburban lifestyle where their homes are secure and their children have good schools and all the kind of suburban value structure that we would point to is very much shared in a racially diverse environment. And that's very different, and that's very separate from the urban experience in central cities for lots of black people. And that's an interesting piece of that class race thing.
I noticed that when you mentioned the upward moving black out of the lower income areas, that you mentioned only money. Many of those blacks, I believe, that are moving up are attempting to escape the crime that's in those lower income areas that he's fleeing from.
Oh,
he wants to get into a place that's free from crime, or he believes it'll be free from crime.
Absolutely. I mean, I was pointing to that cluster of values.
And the crime situation is what makes the white area fear the black is going to move in, because the crime may follow the black that's moving into the area.
Well, see, that's where you get the perceptual problem, because see, historically, and this is again why my anger gets directed at the real estate industry, because historically, what happened in city neighborhoods in northern cities all over the country, and well, not just northern cities, but predominantly northern cities, was that it was when, because of the pressure for housing on black families, hard-working, middle-class black families pull themselves together, buy a new house, get their resources together, buy a new house, are manipulated by the real estate industry, and are only have the possibility of buying a house that's only a few blocks away from the ghetto. That black family attempting to escape from a ghetto environment moves there. The real estate industry then moves in, panic peddles all the whites around the area, does what's called blockbusting. All the whites put their houses up for sale. The real estate people make a whole lot of money, and the place all of a sudden turns within 6 months from being a white community being a black community. In other words, the middle class black families are really manipulated by the real estate industry, and it develops among middle class people, white and black, a kind of a mentality that when a black family arrives, that opens the floodgates, if you will, to use that racist language, and that there is very rapid racial transition. Now, that's been a pattern in American cities for 50 years, which has been aided and abetted by the real estate industry, and they have made millions upon millions of dollars off of destroying neighborhoods like that. Now, it's no wonder then that what you're pointing to is exactly how many folks feel, that white families and black families move into suburban areas or middle-class areas within the city, and they get very nervous because they are moving to escape from some kind of collection of lower income issues that they see, but they are afraid that, you know, that it kind of will follow them. And it's that's probably a very, very strong urban pattern that in some places gets repeated in suburban environments. And that's the kind of thing that you're talking about. And it seems clear to me that I've known lots and lots and lots of white families and lots of black families that have said, you know, particularly in politics, you know, come knock on my door and say, what are you doing to keep the streets clean? What are you doing to keep the bad guys out? What are you doing to, you know, because their values as suburban folk, whites and blacks, was they don't want crime, they want good schools, they want good, you know, all that collection of things. Yeah.
How did the have a problem with the terminology of suburban values, because I think that urban people have the same values. They don't want crime, they don't want bad schools, they don't want bad houses, they don't, you know, so I just tense up a little bit, because I feel like urban people want the same thing. Maybe they just can't afford it, they don't have the money, they have to take it out, or whatever, but it's not that they enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, see, I make a distinction. I think that the class values are really, I think you're right. The class values are the same, whether you're talking about a central city environment or a suburban environment. That there are a set of values that when people reach certain kind of economic levels, they share. So you're right in calling on that. That it's not a distinction, but there are folks with, comparable sets of resources that make decisions to stay in highly dense urban areas or in urban neighborhoods or in suburban neighborhoods. And that I think there are, you know, lots and lots of people that could be in any of those three. And that there is a set of things that draw some people into suburban environments. So it's, you know, like maybe like all three of those things to generalize. You know, maybe all three of those things they share, you know, 90% of the same kind of values. But the 10%, some people want the urban style, central city style, some people want the suburban style. But I think you're right, there's a great commonality, and the kind of dynamic I'm talking about is as, takes somewhat different shape, but it's just as true in central city neighborhoods. You know, I could point to three or four Chicago central city neighborhoods that are going through similar kinds of questions as communities that are organizing themselves around that cluster of values. So you're right, it's not, I would not want to hold out suburbia as a, you know, the only repository of middle class value. Yeah. Yeah.
What role has school busing played in either perpetuating or assisting segregation or assisting integration? As to housing, not as to,
yeah, it's, well, first of all, there's philosophically a, you know, an interesting question about, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, because the, if you affect housing and settlement patterns, you will affect school populations. If you affect school populations, you will affect settlement patterns. There's a, at the University of Chicago, there's a fellow named Gary Orfield, who's just about to come out with a new book in this, which is, and Orfield is just terrific, if you want to really explore it. I would say, to generalize, that you cannot generalize. There are, in Orfield's research, there have been a number of metropolitan areas where the, particularly where there have been central cities and suburban districts that have worked out various kinds of transfer programs, where there have been some very positive effects. I haven't been close enough to that literature that I could really, you know, really dig at with you. Well, as my sense is relatively few, and at least the communities that I've worked mostly with, in Chicago and in Cleveland and some of the places on the East Coast, there has been relatively little connection between municipal governments and school district governments. And that has been a problem that people have been trying to sort. And there's, you know, we've had relatively little success in getting those folks to deal with each other.
Well, it seems to me that many suburban areas have little, if any, inexpensive or federally subsidized housing compared to the cities which they surround. And that automatically means that you've got poor people moving into the central city. Is that right?
Yeah.
So that automatically you're going to have a higher proportion of low-income people, which often means people of color, in the city. So those people who don't have any money, don't have the choice of putting their kids in a suburban school district.
Mm-hmm.
That is just not an option.
Yeah.
And
Yeah. There's a whole parallel discussion to what we're talking about that has to do with exclusionary practices based upon income and what's known as exclusionary zoning. And been a whole series of court cases dealing with exactly the same kind of phenomenon of to what degree does a community have a right to limit or determine the range and value of housing within itself.
Don't both things have to work side by side in order for this process to be reviewed?
Well, I believe so. But the thing that I've seen is that it is that dealing with each is such a massive issue that it's, you know, like the communities that I've dealt directly with. If in addition to dealing with racial diversity, they attempted to take on economic diversity, it is too complex to deal with. And the other problem is that in metropolitan areas where you have communities dealing with racial diversity, there's the problem, what I call the path of least resistance, that as soon as a community, be it an urban neighborhood or a suburban community, begins to really wrestle with racial diversity, it often becomes a target for the funneling, the steering of people of color to that community, and the pressure for low-income housing. It's a very interesting, it's a real interesting phenomenon when those things start to come together.
I'm from Chicago, and we all have a big problem. But the smaller cities have less of a problem, and are they more likely to be integrated and to have less racial problems?
Well, my sense is that smaller metropolitan areas have more overt discriminatory practice and less problem because there are less people looking at it. As we've looked at the metropolitan areas that are related to Chicago, you know, when you look at areas like, you know, Milwaukee, or even the satellites of Chicago, Aurora and Joliet, some of those kind of places, there's a lot of really bad stuff going on from our perspective in terms of discriminatory practices. But because those are not, if you will, major battlegrounds, they're not being looked at. And so it's an interesting paradox that I would be willing to bet that in smaller American communities, there is much more active discriminatory practice that is being much less dealt with. And that...
The blacks and the men you were talking about, like the ones that come up and raise their income, are more educated and raise their income. They
tend
to go to the larger cities then, where the
better jobs are. I don't know. The only it's really difficult to look at to see any long-term trends in terms of black settlement. That's what these numbers represent up here. From the 60s, 60s, 70s, these are the percentages of black settlement in central cities, suburban, and rural areas. And we can see that over the last 25 years, the percentage of persons living in the suburbs who are black has risen from essentially 3% to over 6%. But you know, that's not a giant thing. And there's some indications since the 1980 census that there may be an overall shift of settlement patterns of black families moving from the north to the south. That may have shifted, but we just don't have enough data yet. And who is doing the moving? Is it, some black writers maintain that there is a shift of black academics and professional people back into the South. And there's other people that maintain that the shift is of black working class people who are with everybody else has, you know, shifted to the South because of jobs. But my sense is, at least the numbers I've seen, that we just, you know, I don't know how to generalize about that. You know, what I can say is that there are, you know, fair housing people all over the country know that within their metropolitan areas, there are always a significant number of people of color who are looking for housing. And that's what they're dealing with. Now, whether that number is changing or not, it's hard to say. Yeah.
In your studies where communities have become integrated, even though it may be somewhat limited, has crime increased?
No. As a matter of fact, in the suburbs around Chicago, in the majority of the suburbs, as their populations became more racially diverse, it appeared that their crime rates were going down. But again, we don't have enough, you know, this isn't gone long term enough. And it gets involved by how many, you know, there are all kinds of factors that get involved with that. But, you know, how do you unhook movements of people by color for movements of people by class, for movements of people by other kinds of social factors? That's, you know, that gets really messy in terms of figuring out what are the factors that are key. Yes, ma'am.
Oh, and you're talking about housing. Are you talking also about the rentals as well as the home ownership?
Only indirectly. The major concern with fair housing folks has to do with the with people who are in the home buying market.
Because there are many people who live in apartments.
Right. And
that's pretty much controlled by the owner of the apartment, whether or not it's...
Yeah, but it is again, but there are all the fair housing agencies will deal with some apartment seekers also. And you know, you need to realize too, I mean, a person who owns their own house or owns a unit, you know, they are also covered by the law. You know, it is against the law to discriminate based on race. And
but there are ways that they do get around it, I know, because some people just don't have apartments available at particular times.
Yeah. Is there...
Well,
yeah.
You spent some time here kind of going over the problem, and at least in some of the communities we run into, things like apartments and so on have been pretty well taken care of. They're integrated because the law is very clear and it gets enforced and people speak up. With respect to housing, you've been talking about the real estate industry, what do you consider the solution? Stronger laws, stronger enforcement?
I think there are two things that relate to each other that can go a long way toward dealing with this. One is a commitment on the part of the National Board of Realtors to see that all of their agents are engaged in fair housing training would be extremely helpful. There are a couple of examples in Grand Rapids, and there are a couple other examples around the country where folks have, real estate industry has voluntarily gotten involved with really training their agents to understand the power of their work in regard to racial diversity. I think that could be extremely helpful. Along with that, I think it is very important that local governments have some kind of human relations or fair housing agencies that have teeth to them. Very often the creation of a fair housing, you know, a human relations committee doesn't do it. But there are tried and true methods through which local government can monitor the activity of the real estate industry. And I think those two things together could go a tremendous long way toward changing the climate See, the dilemma is not in the choice of people. The dilemma is that we have to change the market forces, not the decisions of individual families. And if we can change the market forces so that there is, in fact, a unified market, that at whatever income level, in housing and in apartment seeking, at whatever income level they are, if whites and blacks and other minority folk are looking at the same markets, then they're going to be free to choose whatever. Today, they are not looking at the same markets. Today, we continue to have a dual market where the whites look in certain areas, minorities direct in others. It's overcoming that market change.
Based upon your earlier statement, which was that the acceptance of equality is now broad-based, but the next door syndrome is not going to overcome. If those barriers are overcome, are we going to continue to have the same problem because of people not wanting to live next door and moving? And we've had the real estate blockbusters before, but will that be a natural phenomenon that follows? I'm just using your own statistics.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. Well, you know, one of the interesting, curious dilemma is that for almost all of us, buying a house is our major life investment. And it's remarkable how people's attitudes change when it comes to that. I mean, if you have invested in this house, and all of a sudden somebody who you thought you wouldn't like moves onto your block, and you start thinking about putting your house up for sale, but that's a complicated thing. Why should you move just because of that? And all of a sudden, these people, whoever they are, their kids are in school with your kids, and you begin to, oh, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. I mean, when I was in politics, I had all kinds of people, you know, white people and black people say to me, you know, all my life I didn't think I was really going to like white people. And I've been living with these white people on the street, and they're okay. Or all my life I thought I wasn't going to like black people. You know, it's those kinds of things that I think get at that. But those kinds of, and then the ways in which churches and others build community. But that kind of thing doesn't become a possibility until we affect the market. Yeah, but I think we can deal with it. It's 5:00. Thank you all very much. Please remember these are headlines. It's a lot more complicated.